Chapter 14, The Last Chapter, Power and Change. During most of its history, the citizens of Texas were poor. When the Garzas trekked north from Zacatecas in 1724, they were virtual slaves, with pitiful housing, inadequate food, and never a second set of clothing. The early Quimpers lived in an earthen cave, without knowing bread, for almost a year. The McNabs did, through a ruse, get land, but they were always land poor, and when young Otto finally became a Texas Ranger, he served for miserable pay, if any, and was expected to provide his own horse, gun, and clothing. Because the supply of money was so rigidly controlled, he rarely had any. The Alarcamps labored like lackeys, all of them, and it was a long time before they had enough to live with any sense of ease. The two Cobb families from Carolina and Georgia had real slaves, a thriving gin and a lumber mill, but their Jefferson neighbors did not. Of 100 Cobb slaves, the 90 field hands lived in poverty. They had enough food, but not a decent house or proper clothes. And during the Civil War and the Reconstruction, even the white folks in the plantation mansions knew real deprivation. When Fort Garner folded, Emma Larkin and her husband Earnshaw Rusk owned a fine set of stone buildings and thousands of acres, but they had no money with which to operate. They spent carefully, but because they could not save up even a few dollars in ready cash, they almost lost their holdings. That was the condition of Texas. Plenty of land, a niggardly existence, a dream of better days. However, with the 1901 discovery of limitless petroleum deposits at Spindletop near Beaumont, some Texans began to accumulate tremendous riches, and by the 1920s, even families as far west as the Rusks in Larkin County shared in the bonanza. In Texas, one could leap from land poor to oil rich in one generation, or one weekend. Now, the perpetual poverty of Texas was obscured by the conspicuous display of wealth, and the history of the state began to be told in dollar signs followed by big numbers. And some could be very big, because here and there certain lucky Texans became billionaires. To the rest of the nation, it sometimes looked as if the dollar sign governed the state. For example, as the decade of the 1980s opened, the whole state seemed to be on what gamblers called a roll, with each throw of the dice producing a winning 7 or 11. Everything looked so promising that enthusiasts started voicing the old boast, "This can go on forever." There was solid reason for believing that Texas was certain to achieve national leadership, for the census then underway would show that the state had gained so much population, 3,009,728 in 10 years, it would gain 3 new seats in Congress, while the less fortunate states in the cold Northeast would lose twice that number. As always, oil was the harbinger of good fortune, and when, with help from the Arab states, it soared to $36 a barrel, Ransom Rusk's bank in Midland told its depositors, "Oil has got to go to 60. Expand now." And funds were provided for this next round of extraordinary gambling. Airlines with a strong Texas base, like Braniff and Continental, freed at last from the petty regulations of the Civil Aeronautics Board, were flying into scores of new cities and picking up astronomical profits, while Tex-Tech, the computer sensation based in Dallas, was, as its shareholders boasted, soaring right off the top of that big board they run in Wall Street. More than 2 dozen millionaires had been created through ownership of this stock, with 3 or 4 early investors, like Rusk, garnering nearly $500 million each. The sensation of the Texas scene, however, was Houston real estate, for it had no discernible upward limit. Farmers who owned land to the north and west of the city could demand almost any price an acre, $50,000, $100,000, and there were many takers who knew that with just a little break, they could peddle it off at $1 million an acre. Investors from West Germany and Saudi Arabia were hungry for Houston real estate. But the major profits came from those Mexican politicians who had stolen their country blind and were now stashing their fortunes in the security provided by Houston hotels and condominiums. Anyone who could build anything in Houston could sell it. Office space, hotels, condominiums, private homes. And if real estate ever did lag, the city could rely upon its oil industry. Houston is the hottest ticket in the world, its boosters said. The aspect of Texas life which seemed to give its noisier citizens the greatest boost was the Dallas Cowboys football team. Dubbed by an enthusiastic publicist America's Team, it caught the nation's fancy, and year after year its stalwarts appeared in the playoffs and bowl games. At the same time, in obedience to the sage precepts established by Friday night high school football, young women were enrolled in the madness, the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders becoming famous for the skimpiest costumes and the sexiest routines. A Cowboys home game became a ritual at which devout Texans worshipped, for the players on the field were heroic, and the cheerleaders along the sidelines irresistible. Boasted one partisan, "Our football girls make those in New York and Denver look like dogs." Just as the Larkin-fighting antelopes had consolidated public enthusiasm in that small Texas town, so the Dallas Cowboys solidified enthusiasm and loyalty across Texas and in many other parts of the nation. Nowhere was Texas optimism more obvious than in Larkin, where Ransom Rusk judged the week beginning the 2nd of November 1980 to be the finest he had ever known. He was 57 years old, and resigned to the fact that the rest of his days would be spent in convenient bachelorhood. His mansion in Larkin was now staffed exclusively by illegal Mexican immigrants who performed well and taught him Spanish. The bowling lawn, which had dominated his life during his married years, was now a pleasant grassland, kept reasonably neat by a gang mower that shaved it twice a month. One could say that he spent Sunday of this week with his beasts, for as his relations with other human beings, starting with his divorce from Fleurette, diminished, his reliance upon animal friends increased. Early morning was dedicated to his armadillos, a mother, father, and four males this time. They had dug themselves into both his garden and his heart, and had learned to come for vegetable roots when he whistled, their golden bodies shimmering in the dawn. At about 10 in the morning, he rode out to his ranch, also run exclusively by Mexicans, none legal residents, and a more pleasant day he could not recall. Some 7 years back, he had gotten rid of his white-faced Herefords, the breed introduced by his grandfather Earnshaw, and had started raising Texas Longhorns, whose strain had been kept alive by his grandmother, Emma Larkin Rusk. He had purified his herd until it contained only the MM/BB strain, animals descended from Mean Moses and Bathtub Bertha. On Sunday mornings, he liked to observe a ritual that recreated the grandeur of the vanishing Texas frontier. Throwing a heavy paper sack in his jeep, he would drive down the lane leading away from his ranch house and into a large fenced-in field, at whose far end stood a beautifully scattered grove of trees. There, on a rise, he would halt the jeep, blow the horn 3 times, and stand in the open, rustling his stiff paper bag. On this Sunday, he did so for at least 10 minutes, accomplishing nothing. And then, slowly, from distant trees, shadowy forms began to emerge, hesitant, cautious, for they were wily animals. But as the sound of possible feed reached them, they became more daring, and big longhorn steers, handsomely mottled in gray and brown and white, began walking tentatively toward Rusk. Another appeared, and then another, until more than 30 had left the trees. And when they were in the open, reassured that no danger awaited them, they broke into a quiet lope that soon turned into a run. On they came, these wonderful animals out of the past, whose survival had been made possible only because some Texans loved them. And as they drew closer, Rusk could see once more the tremendous horns these selected steers carried, great rocking chairs set on their heads. When they were nearly upon him, hungry for the food he promised, he studied them as if they were his children, and jumbled thoughts raced through his head. No plotting man framed your character. Nature built you, alone on the prairies. Storm killed off your weaklings. Drought slaughtered those that had no will to survive. In years of hunger, you learn to eat almost anything, to forage off the moss of rocks. Through merciless selection, you learn to produce very small calves with a fantastic determination to grow into big adults. I don't waste money on veterinarians when I raise you longhorns. You animals raise yourselves just like us Texans. When the first steers were eating all about him, so close that he could reach out and touch them, a huge old animal emerged from the woods and started walking in stately steps toward the feast. And when he approached, the others moved aside. He was Montezuma, self-appointed lord of the herd, and he maintained his noble advance until he stood nose to nose with Rusk, demanding to be fed by hand. For a moment, these two survivors, gamblers of the plain, stood together, the great horns of Montezuma practically encircling Rusk. Of all the cattle in the world, only you longhorns produce a steer worth saving. Steers of all other strains are sent off to the butcher at age 2, but you live on because men prize you and want to see you sharing their land, for you remind them of the cleaner days. It's good to see you, Montezuma. As he stood there, surrounded by these incredible beasts, he could not escape as a businessman making a calculation. After the war between the states, when Texas hadn't a nickel, our grandfathers herded 10 million longhorns to cow towns like Dodge. At $40 a head, that meant $400 million pumped into the Texas economy, when scarcely a dime was reaching it from other sources. Montezuma, you longhorns rebuilt this state. Saluting his treasures, he drove back to a remarkable new building adjoining his mansion, and there, as his Mexican butler served cold drinks, he watched his favorites, the Dallas Cowboys, play at St. Louis. Had the game been in Dallas, he would have occupied his private box, entertaining, as usual, 12 or 14 business acquaintances. He cheered when Wolfgang McNabb, a linebacker he had sent to the University of Texas on a football scholarship, mowed down St. Louis like an avenging scythe. "Tear 'em apart, Wolfman. I knew back then you were headed for greatness." The building in which he sat was named the African Hall, for it resembled a stone lodge he had seen in South Africa's famed Kruger Park. He had built the place in his loneliness after his divorce, when he had associated himself with a group of bachelors in similar circumstances who took safaris to Kenya, where in the splendor of its animal parks they shot kudu and giraffe and lion, bringing the heads home to be displayed on Texas walls. Rusk's hall was one of the best, and to sit surrounded by his handsome trophies while his cowboys rampaged on the TV screen was a delight. On Monday, when he drove to his office in Fort Worth, his two accountants asked if they might see him, and he expected trouble, for they rarely approached with good news. But this time was different. "Mr. Rusk, a singular development in Mid-Continent Gas has produced a situation in which you may be interested." At the mention of this name, Rusk had to smile, one of his thin, sardonic smiles, because he was thinking of the time when the Carpenter Field roared in with an almost unlimited supply of natural gas. "Remember how my stupidity made me miss that bonanza completely?" But the field had been operating only briefly when he saw an opportunity for a gamble of staggering dimension. The owners had no way of getting their gas to market, so I organized Mid-Continent and guaranteed them 32 cents a 1,000 cubic feet for all they could produce for the next 40 years. They jumped, thinking they'd stuck me with gas I wouldn't be able to market either. "I worked on that pipeline you bulldogged through the hills," the chief accountant recalled. "Nobody believed you could do it, including me. That was one hell of a job, Mr. Rusk." Against professional advice, against prodigious odds, Rusk had driven his pipeline across 67 miles of rolling hell, and when he was through, he found an insatiable market for his gas. "I bought it at 32 cents, sold it for $1.10, and thought I was making a fortune. But when it went to $3.22, I did make a fortune, 1,000% profit. And for the past 2 years, we've sold it for $9.18. That's a nearly 3,000% profit. and all because we took those insurmountable chances. That's what we wanted to show you, the accountants said. And on a pristine sheet, as neat as a tennis court, they presented him with two figures. New estimated value, mid-continent gas at present prices, $448 million. New estimated value, your total holdings, $1,060 million. When Rusk looked briefly at the figures, he realized that he was now officially Texas rich. It was in large part due to the antics of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, which had so increased the value of his oil holdings that he had accumulated some $90 million which he had not known about. Rusk had never been heard to say a bad word about OPEC, his standard comment among his friends being, "Maybe those Arabs are extortionists, but they do our work for us." If oil still brought $10 a barrel, he would not be a billionaire. But when the price soared to nearly 40, he became one. "It will go to 60," he predicted. And based on this hope, he doubled his stable of rigs and drilling crews. He also believed that the northeast section of the United States must accustom itself to much higher prices for Texas gas, of which he was now a major supplier. "For too long, they've had a free ride at our expense. I don't want to gouge them, but I do want them to pay their share of the freight." To arguments advanced by some that such talk represented an economic holdup and a conscious drive to steal the leadership of the United States away from New York and Boston and into the so-called Sunbelt, he replied, "The leadership of this nation rests with those of us who see its future clearly and who use creatively whatever leverage God has given us. The future must lie with those parts of the nation which have our remarkable mix, oil, brains, and courage." He was never arrogant about his beliefs, advancing them quietly but with irresistible force. When truck drivers employed by his companies to move oil pasted insulting bumper stickers on their vehicles, "Let those bastards up there freeze," he made them scrape them off. But he did allow them to keep others that came close to representing his thoughts, "Yankees out of God's country." And he positively chuckled over the brilliance of the beer advertising which proclaimed that Lone Star was the national beer of Texas. "We are our own nation," he told his friends, "and it's our duty to see that our ideas prevail throughout the friendly nation which lies to the north." He was not speaking of Canada. It would be a mistake to visualize Rusk as some weazened gnome, evil in purpose, huddling in his vault at night counting his wealth. He was tall, straight, beetle-browed, good-looking, and easily able to smile when not furiously pursuing some special interest. But more than a year could pass without his being more than vaguely aware of the value of his holdings. He certainly never brooded about it. He knew it was tremendous, and he intended keeping it that way, as his daring support of Pierre Solt's Texas Technologies proved. Tex-Tech had not merely been a good idea, it had been stupendous, and under the inspired leadership of the Frenchman, had often swept the field before competitors even guessed what the company had in its long-range plans. Office-sized computers, word processors, software, superb merchandising, Tex-Tech had pioneered them all, and in doing so had multiplied Rusk's impulsive investment many times. This enabled him to operate rather boldly in fields which concerned him, such as the disciplining of labor and the expulsion from public life of woolly-headed liberals like many of the northern senators. But he never thought of himself as reactionary. "I represent the Texas experience. The land, always the land. My grandmother had no nose, no ears, but she did have this glorious land we sit on. My grandfather, that crazy Quaker, was a dreamer who stocked their land with those great bulls from England. My father probed the land for oil, and because I was working the land with seismology, I stumbled into Tex-Tech. We never had any nefarious designs, no special tricks. We stayed close to the land and accumulated power, which I am obligated to use sagaciously." But it was not the placid Sunday in the country or the startling financial news on Monday which made this week so memorable. Tuesday was election day, the culmination of Rusk's effort to bring this nation back to its senses, and he rose early in his frugal Fort Worth apartment and drove out to Larkin to cast his vote. He rarely used one of his Mexicans as a chauffeur because he loved the feel of a big car eating up the superb Texas highways. And on this exciting day, when he had lots of time, he opted for a road that was only slightly longer than the direct route through Jacksboro. He preferred this more southerly road, for it took him through Mineral Wells, where he liked to stop at the edge of town and contemplate an enormous building that dominated the skyline. 50 years ago, it was one of the supreme hotels in America. Hollywood stars, New York bankers, everybody came here to take the waters. How many rooms? How much glory? And now, a rotting shell. On 3 different occasions, excited investors had come to him with plans for revitalizing the great spa, and always he had told them, "It was a fine idea in its day. Well, that day has gone. Look at it standing there empty, a ghost of Texas grandeur. And look at the little motel at its feet, filled all the time. You change with the times, or the times steamroller you." From Mineral Wells, he headed for Graham, where he controlled 12 wells, and then on to Larkin, where the 10 o'clock crowd of women voters filled the polling places. He cast his ballot in the basement of the handsome courthouse, then went to his home to make and receive telephone calls. 6 years earlier, he and a handful of other Texas oil men had quietly assembled to discuss the future of their state and their nation in that order, and he had warned them, "God and the American way have allowed us to accumulate tremendous power in this republic, and we would be craven if we did not apply it intelligently. That means that we must defeat communists in office, regardless of what state they operate from, and replace them with decent Americans." "Have we the right to interfere in other states?" a timid man from Dallas asked. And he snapped, "When McGovern casts his South Dakota vote in the Senate against our interests, he becomes a Texas senator, and I say, kick him the hell out of South Dakota. We've got to protect South Dakota from its own errors." "You're saying that we'll enter campaigns in all the states?" "Wherever there's a man who votes against the interests of Texas. To accomplish this cleansing of public life, we must spend money, and I mean a great deal. We're fighting for the future of this great nation." In the present election, he had, by various intricate devices, poured contributions into different campaigns across the country. The bulk of it went to support Ronald Reagan, a most attractive man who had often lectured to Texas business groups on the dangers of communism, the need to muzzle our central bureaucracy, and the absolute necessity of eliminating the national debt. But Rusk had also pinpointed various Democratic senators, real crazy liberals, who had to be defeated, plus a variety of notorious congressmen who had spoken against what he called big oil. All of them were to be expunged. And as the long day wore on, he spoke with various allies around the nation. "Rance, looks like we might oust them all. Glorious day for the Republic." Before the sun had set in Texas, he was assured, as he sat alone in his Larkin mansion before the 2 television sets, that Reagan had won. But he was startled by the ineptness of Jimmy Carter in handling the situation. "My God, he's conceding while the western polls are still open. That must damage his people in tight races out there." He threw down the newspaper, whose tabulations he was checking off. "That poor peanut grower never had a clue. How did we ever allow him to be president?" Still, the resplendent night rolled on, and during an exulting phone call to friends in Houston, he shouted, "By damn, we showed them how to win an election. We cleaned house on the whole damned bunch." He did not go to bed, for he wanted to hear the final Alaska returns. And when he learned that candidates he had backed so heavily retained a slight lead, with prospects of a much larger one when the rural districts came in, he leaned back, stared at the ceiling, and reflected, "A man works diligently for what he believes in, and when the fight grows hot, he'd better throw in all his reserves. What did we contribute, one way and another? $11 million, more or less. Small price to pay for the defeat of known enemies of the people. Small price to ensure good government. Toward morning, he learned that the Democrats had held on to their seat in Hawaii, but he dismissed this with a growl. They're all Japs anyway. They'd bear some looking into. Maybe next time we can fix that. Of 9 Democratic incumbents that his team had targeted, 7 had been defeated. And as the sun rose on Wednesday morning, he told his fellow conspirators on the conference call, "We're going to rebuild this nation to make it more like Texas." When an oil man in Midland asked what that meant, he said, "Religion, patriotism, the old-fashioned virtues, and willingness to stand up and fight anybody, the things that make any nation great." His father, Fat Floyd, had voiced exactly those sentiments 60 years earlier. But then, when Texas seemed impregnable, changes began to take place in all aspects of Texas life. Subtly at first, like a wisp of harmless smoke at the edge of a prairie, then turning into a firestorm which threatened all the assumed values. The Sherwood Cobbs, at their cotton farm west of Lubbock, were one of the first families to detect the shift. One afternoon, an event occurred which seemed a replay of that day in 1892, when a former slave ran to the plantation house at Jefferson with the startling news that boll weevils had eaten away the heart of the cotton crop. That information had altered life in Texas, and now another virtual slave, brown this time instead of black, Eloy Musquiz, the illegal Mexican field hand, came running to the Cobb kitchen with news of equal import. "Mr. Cobb, deep well number 9, no water." "Electricity fail?" The 1952 Chevy engines were no longer used. "No, we tested. Plenty spark." "Maybe the pump's gone." Cobb said this with a sick feeling, because for some months he had been aware that the water table upon which the Lubbock area depended had dropped toward the danger point. Could the failure of number 9, a strong well, be a warning that the mighty Ogallala Aquifer was failing? He did not hazard a guess. During the first 10 years on their cotton farm in Leveland, the Sherwood Cobbs realized that they had, by some fortunate chance, stumbled upon a paradise. Of course, it had required a special aptitude for anyone to appreciate that it was a paradise, for their land was so flat that even when the slightest haze intervened, no horizon could be identified. It started level and went on forever. Also, it contained not a tree, and what locally passed for a hedgerow was apt to be 6 inches high and covered with dust. Distances to stores and towns were forbidding, and when the sun went seriously to work in June, the average temperature stayed above 90 day and night for nearly 4 months. In 1980, there had been 20 days, almost in succession, when it soared above 100. But with air conditioning, it was bearable, and during the winter months there were about 12 inches of snow. White gold, the farmers called it, because it lingered and seeped into the ground. Of course, extreme cold sometimes accompanied the snow, with the thermometer dropping to -17 on one historic occasion. Only rarely did the year's total rainfall exceed 16 inches, but with deep pumps working, water from the aquifer was poured out in a stream so reliable that the cotton really seemed to jump out of the ground. "The part I appreciate," Cobb said, "is that you can lay the water exactly where you want it, when you want it." He also mixed fertilizer and needed minerals in the flow, so that while he irrigated, he also nourished. "You might call it farming by computer," he told his sons. "We calculate what we've taken from the soil and then put it back. Same amounts. Properly handled, fields like ours could go on forever." The results were more than gratifying. Back east, a bale of lint to an acre. Here, 2 bales, and of a superior quality. This area around Lubbock was the dominant producer in America, and one of the best in the world. A gin like Cobb's, on the road from Leveland to shallow water, produced 500-pound bales of pure silver. So consistent was the quality, and so assured the value. Brokers in Lubbock often dominated the world's markets, for what they supplied and in what quantity determined standards and prices. Imagine, Cobb exulted one night after finishing a long run with his gin, finding land where there's always enough water and a boll weevil can't live. It was a cotton grower's dream, which explained why so many of the plantation owners in East Texas had made the long leap west. But now, as he jumped in his pickup to inspect number 9, he had a suspicion that the great years might be ending, and he inspected the silent well only a few minutes before telling Muskies, "Go get the Ericssons." When the brothers drove up to the well, Cobb clenched his teeth as they delivered the fatal news. "Same everywhere. The Ogallala has dropped so fast. These dry spells, the extra wells you fellows have put in. What can I do? For the present, we can chase the water. Meaning, deepen all your wells. How much deeper? The red bed, on which our part of the Ogallala rests, is 200 feet down. The wells we dug for you back in 1968 go down only 100 feet. What did they cost? $3,500 per well. How many must I deepen? 20. And the estimates they placed before him showed that the cost of merely deepening an existing well was going to be more than twice the cost of one of the original 5. To do the digging, $1,500. To install the submersible pump, $5,000. To wire for electricity and protect the system, $1,000. Total per well, $7,500. Total cost per 20 wells, $150,000. "Have I any alternative?" Cobb asked. And the brothers agreed, "None." Then the younger added, "Each year the aquifer drops only slightly, but the rate of fall is steady, and soon it'll fall below your present pumps. But if we go down to Red Bed, you ought to be safe for the rest of this century." The older brother summed it up. "Stands to reason, Cobb, you wouldn't want to call us back to redig your wells 2 or 3 times just to keep pace with the drop. Dig 'em once, dig 'em right, dig 'em deep." So Cobb chased the aquifer downward. Even those farms which used windmills to work their pumps, and many did, had to deepen their wells. But when the pipes were safely down, these farms had assured water, because the winds on the plains could be relied upon. And sometimes they can be trusted to blow the whole mill, flat as a freshly plowed field. Weather in the Lubbock area was rugged, no doubt about it. With the blazing summers, the frigid winters, and now and then a tornado to keep people attentive. But the challenges could be rewarding, and the warm social life of the area diverted attention from the hardships. The Cobbs were especially appreciative of the local university, Texas Technological College it had been called when they arrived, but with the hard practicality which governed so much of Texas life, the legislature had listened to the complaint of a West Texas representative. "Hell, everybody calls it Texas Tech, and that's how those who love it name it. I propose that the name be officially changed to Texas Tech, and while we're about it, let's make it a full university." So there it was, Texas Tech University, with a curriculum of agricultural, mechanical, and modest liberal arts programs. Its students were sought after in the oil fields and in Silicon Valley, but what residents like the Cobbs especially appreciated were the cultural programs it sponsored. A string quartet now and then, a choral presentation of an opera, no sets, no costumes, or a series of 3 Shakespearean plays. Challenging lectures were available, with notable conservatives like William Buckley applauded, and farmers like the Cobbs could easily arrange casual meetings with the professors. But what gratified Nancy Cobb and attracted her most often to the university was the unequaled ranch museum it had put together, a collection of houses and buildings assembled from all over the state, showing how ranchers had lived in the various periods. 30 minutes among these simple structures, with their rifle ports for holding off the Comanche, taught more of Texas history than a dozen books. One hot afternoon in 1981, when Nancy had taken a group of visitors from the north to see the open-air museum, it covered many acres. She was standing before one of the box and strip houses built by the 1910 pioneers, and explaining how the settlers, deprived of any local timber, had imported it precariously from hundreds of miles to the east, and had then used it like strips of gold to shore up their mud-walled huts. And as she talked, she began to choke. It must have been so hellish for the women. One symposium series gave the Cobbs a lot of trouble, for a lecturer predicted that the day would come, and possibly within this century, when the rising cost of electricity and the constant lowering of the water table would make agriculture on the Western Plains uneconomic. And I do not mean marginally uneconomic. I mean that you will have to close down your wells, abandon your cotton fields, and sell off your gins to California, where their farmers, because of sensible planning, will have water. We would then see towns like Leveland and Shallow Water revert to the way they were when the Indians roamed. Except that, here and there, the traveler would find the roots of houses which had once existed, and the remnants of towns and villages. We could avoid this catastrophe if all the states dependent upon the Ogallala Aquifer united in some vast plan to protect that resource. But all would have to obey the decisions, because any one state, following its own selfish rules and depleting the aquifer, could defeat the strategy. Cobb, extremely sensitive to the problem of which he was a vital part, and interested in possible solutions, raised enough donations from local farmers and ranchers to offer Texas Tech funds for conducting a symposium on Ogallala and the West, which attracted serious students from across Texas and representatives of the governments of all the Ogallala states. It was a gala affair, with Governor Clements giving the keynote address, and with two lectures each morning and afternoon on the crises confronting the Western states. As the talks progressed, especially those informal ones late at night, several harsh and inescapable conclusions began to emerge. The Ogallala was not inexhaustible, and at its present rate of depletion, might cease to function effectively sometime after the year 2010. Diversion of rivers, and especially the snowmelt from the eastern face of the Rockies, could be let into it to revitalize it, but such water was already spoken for. Strict apportionment at levels far below today's usage would prolong its life. State departments of agriculture were prepared to recommend more than a dozen ways in which farmers and ranchers could use less water. Texas would soon see the day when it would be profitable to purchase from surrounding states like Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana, and perhaps from those as far away as Colorado, entire rivers and streams whose water would be piped onto its thirsty fields. Delegates from the named states hooted this proposal. Commercial desalinization of Gulf waters plus great pipelines west might well be the answer, if nuclear energy were to become available at low rates. Every state, right now, must organize itself on a statewide basis to ensure the most prudent use of every drop of water that fell thereon. It was in the working out of this last recommendation, which the conference adopted unanimously, that Cobb learned how divisive a subject this was insofar as Texas water users were concerned. Because when the Texas delegation met, these points were stressed by the more active participants. Ransom Rusk, Longhorn Breeder. Every word said makes sense, but what we must take steps to ensure is that cattle raisers be allowed to retain the water rights on which they've built their herds, often at great expense. Lorenzo Quimper, operator of 9 large ranches, some with serious water deficiencies. Regulation and apportionment are inescapable, but we must protect the backbone industries of the state, and in them I include ranching. Cattle cannot live without water, and from time immemorial their rights have been predominant and must remain so if Texas is to continue the traditions which made it great, and, I must say, unique. Charles Rampart, cotton grower north of Lubbock. You need only look at the level of the aquifer year by year to know that something must be done. But the prior rights of our wells in this agricultural area, and I drilled mine in the 1950s, they've got to be respected. All the wells in this region will have to be grandfathered. If they're in, they stay in. Sam Quiller, farmer, Sevier County. The irrigation ditches that lead off the Brazos River to water my fields date back to 1818. Any court of law would support my claim that those rights, and in the amounts stated, are irreversible. Read Muttle v. Boyd, and you'll find you cannot impede the flow of the Brazos. Tom and Fred Bartleson, fishermen, mouth of the Brazos. Water must be regulated. We all know that. But I would ask you to keep in mind that Texas courts have said repeatedly, and confirmed repeatedly, that a constant flow from rivers like the Brazos must be maintained so that a proper salinity in the waters just offshore be protected. That's where we catch our fish. Those are the waters our restaurants and supermarkets depend upon. At the end of the conference, it was pathetically clear that Nebraska, Colorado, and all the other aquifer states would repel even the slightest attack upon their sovereignty, and that every user in Texas appreciated the need for others to conserve water so long as his inherited rights were not infringed. Almost every drop of water inland from the Gulf Coast had been spoken for, usually in the 19th century, and to reapportion it or even control it was going to be impossible. Since the Ogallala Aquifer was a resource which could not be seen, the general public had no incentive to protect it. The Brazos and the Colorado and the Trinity were already allocated and could not be touched. Arkansas and Louisiana needed the water they had and would repel with bayonets anyone who attempted to lead away even a trickle. So all that could be done was to continue exactly as things were, and then, sometime in the decade starting in 2010, when disaster struck, take emergency measures. No, Cobb cried when the insanity of this solution hit him. What we should do right now is build a huge channel from the Mississippi into Wichita Falls, and pipelines from there to the various Texas regions. The idea was not fatuous, for millions of acre-feet of wasted water ran off each year past New Orleans. But when he seriously proposed such a ditch as a solution, experts pointed out, such a channel would have to run through Arkansas and Oklahoma, and that would not be permitted.